thank you everybody for coming back. We're starting 10 minutes late. We will have the 90 minutes for this session as planned, so don't worry about the timing. As before, we're going to have all three papers and then the Q&A to all of the speakers at the end of the talks. This is a tag team. She's there. Angela and Jimmy are speaking together, and they are Chimera, I love this, made up from parts of historian, sociologist and SDS scholars at the Centre for Rural Policy Research at the University of Exeter, and they're collaborating on the project From Feed the Birds to Do Not Feed the Animals, a Wellcome Trust funded project. So I'll hand over to the two of you.
Brilliant, thanks Erica, thanks everyone. Yeah, so I'm Ginny and Angela, and Ollie, who's also working on this with us, isn't here this weekend unfortunately, but we're all part of this larger project on the sort of drivers and consequences of human feeding of other animals. And our particular parts, mine looks at feeding of wildlife, Angela's feeding intentionally or unintentionally of pests, and Ollie of zoo life. And we're sort of pulling all that together to look at feeding as a form of care. And so what we're doing today, the plan is to sort of look at care generally and moving beyond its sort of the understanding of the folk concept of care to its more sort of complex and more problematic understandings, and then use the case studies of our individual research to illustrate that. And then the idea is at the end, we'll, with your help, and eventually over the fullness of time, pull all that together into a sort of broader understanding, a broader analysis of care across multiple dimensions. So that's the plan, and Angela's going to tell us the theory of it.
Okay. Yeah, you've got me talking about theory. I'm not sure this is a great plan. But so where we're coming at with this particular paper, this is great, I can see this, fantastic, is thinking about this thing called care. And, you know, as you're all aware, there's been just this burgeoning and burgeoning and burgeoning literature around care. But one of the things that we started to notice as we're reading it is that a lot of the time, care seems to be sort of written about in this really self-evident way. But when you actually start thinking about it, even just in terms of how it's used in language, there's all these different aspects of care. So care can be a noun, it can be a verb, it can be about positive or negative emotions, it can be about paying attention to something, it can be about your actions and practices, it can be about intentions, it can be about desires. But one thing that does seem to be reasonably constant is that care involves a carer or carers and a cared for. But that cared for can be very variable. It can be an individual, it can be a living being, it can be an idea, it can be a collective, it can be an imaginary. So once we started kind of looking at this, we were thinking, well, maybe it might be useful to start unpacking these different aspects of care a little bit more. And also thinking kind of about our various work and how it's quite socially and historically, empirically situated, drawing on particularly Anne-Marie Moll's early work on diabetes care, talking about care as practice and how she's talking about how care is constantly arising through practice and it's constantly being made and remade. And so coming at this less as an ethical project, more as a social and historical project, for us this kind of raises this question of how does care change over time? How does it change across different cultures? How does it change within cultures? And also, how is it multiple and different? And just by the way, this is the only badger you're going to see in this presentation, but it's just such a good illustration of care as interaction that I couldn't resist, frankly. So this is kind of what this paper is about, and it's trying to think with cases, but also beyond cases. So kind of in the course of our various research, and again, this is something that's been coming up through the literature, there's lots of people in this room who've been looking at these kinds of things, is case studies of discomforting care. So care that's uncomfortable, thinking about how sometimes caring practices do involve hurting and killing. So thinking about situations where people have to weigh up life, death and suffering, thinking about surgery where you have to injure in order to care, issues around human and non-human healthcare and how they're very, very different in how they weigh these things up. Thinking about not humans and non-humans in laboratory research. Another way in which you get a weighing up that we think is kind of a bit different is thinking about individuals and collective lives. So thinking about public health, thinking about epidemiology and infectious diseases, but also thinking about ecology and conservation care. And by the way, there are loads and loads of references that should belong in this slide, but there just aren't room for them. So just kind of fill them in your own head, partly in the interests of time. There's also a literature that talks more specifically about farming and gardening, which I think explores some of these ambiguities of care in really interesting ways. So literature around farming care and how farmers themselves often think about the care that they do as stewardship. So sometimes of livestock, of animal herds, in the long term, so very much caring for collectives, stewardship of landscapes, and also care for human communities being really fundamental to their versions of care. Literature on gardening, that gardening itself is a fundamentally nurturing practice, but it's one that also always has to involve pruning, weeding, pest control, killing, and structuring. And finally, and I don't know if this fits or not, because it's not a piece of literature that often gets brought into conversation here, but Zygmunt Bauman's long-standing sociology work, when he writes about Nazi Germany and modernist states as a gardening state, that it involves this logic of what belongs, that is nurtured, and who and what does not belong, the other is not just not nurtured but killed. So there's that bringing together of care and aggression and harm. And it's a difficult thing to think about in conversation with this other literature, but I do wonder whether it's kind of productive to think about those things. So running on as quickly as I can, the other thing that we think about is that much of these discomforting forms of care, unsurprisingly, bring with them strong disagreements, but interestingly not inevitably. And so thinking about, again, we think it's really important to be thinking about some of these classic things around human-animal relationships, but also moral debates within human medical ethics, thinking about environmental ethics, and thinking about how these differences. Sometimes there's literature in political science that's now really thinking about polarization and how that creates its own dynamics, which is quite often one of those aspects of polarization is not just disagreement, but also the idea that within whichever group you're looking at, that we really care about this thing, and those people we oppose really don't care, and that's a reason to be very opposed to them. So, in looking around for literature that tries to put these different versions of care next to each other, the literature we found most helpful is, so it's Gail Davis et al., but it's a very large et al., and there are several people in this room who are a part of that et al., but this idea of cultures of care, we've found one of the things that's most useful to try and put together some of these different ideas about care and hold them together. So in terms of, again, thinking about care as part of practice, but also part of knowledge building, that the co-production of good care and good science, and using that framework, and this is something that they're working on very much at the moment, to think across different cultures of care. And this is also something I've applied in my earlier work on badger culling. Okay, so this is where it gets a bit strange. So This is something that I scrolled during a conference session, and it was a good conference session. I wasn't Googling doodling because it was a bad one, it was a good one. Is starting to think about, well, there are these different aspects of care, and that sometimes we think about kind of weighing up life and suffering, but maybe that's not a helpful opposition. Maybe we should be thinking about these as different dimensions that kind of intersect each other in different contexts. So thinking about suffering and flourishing might be more helpful, thinking about the collective and the personal perspective. And so life and death is much more obvious. But we're not sure if, firstly, these are the only axes. There may be other things to think about. We're also not sure if this is the best way to present it. So this is very much the idea of a three-dimensional axes thing. It's a bit like so this is sometimes how scientists will plot something on three dimensions. Now, we're not actually saying that we would be able to quantitatively plot this. This is about conceptual space. And so we're using animal feeding as a lens for kind of investigating these different aspects of care. And so that's where I'm going to move into the next part of the presentation, where we'll move away from theory and talk a little bit about our case studies. So back to Ginny.
Yes, so these are our three individual research projects which we're using as case studies to dig into this. And this is mine. I'm looking at conservation of wildcats. Wildcats are our only native feline in this country. We've added domestic cats into the mix, but the domestic cat is actually derived from the African wildcat rather than the European wildcat, which is what we have. So wildcats are of least concern globally in terms of their conservation status, but in this country, they're critically endangered. And so we're very concerned about them. And part of that complexity is that they hybridize what I should have said is we're not even sure how many there are. Their estimates range from there being a few hundred to basically none, just this remnant population of hybrids. And the hybrids come from the fact that wildcats are interfertile with the domestic cat, and then the hybrid offspring are also fertile. So you get this crossing and back crossing, and eventually you end up with this hybrid swarm of a population that's just a mix of domestic and wildcat genes. And the hybrids get really problematic because we don't know who or what to care for or about. So people are really worried about the wildcat. They're concerned about it. They want to conserve it. But then the hybrid cat really complicates this. We were just at the National Museum of Scotland yesterday, and they talked about hybrids polluting the pure wildcat gene pool. So some people, you could argue that hybrids are now filling a really important niche, that they're much more suited to the anthropogenic environment they find themselves in. So there's a lot of care about and for the hybrid, but in a really contested way. And then what you get is when you get these really low numbers of wildcats, the reason that hybridization often occurs is that because there aren't many wildcats left, they're roaming further and further to find a mate and encountering domestic cats, often feral domestic cats. So you add the feral domestic cat into the mix, and how do we care for and about that? We care a lot about our domestic cats because they're our pets, we have a responsibility for them. And sort of by extension, that means we care about feral cats, but it, again, following on from Van Doren and some of the violence that's been talked about, it gets to be a very complex and compromised practice of care, because if you care about wildcats and conservation, that has implications for how you care about feral cats and domestic cats. And the way that manifests through feeding is if you're a wild cat, there are really elaborate captive breeding programs to try and build a population that can then be released and self-sustaining in the wild. So if you're breeding in captivity, you're obviously feeding in captivity. So you have to develop these really sophisticated ways of feeding captive wildcats that retain some sort of distance between the human and the wildcat so that there's no habituation or dependency, and also so that you equip these cats to be wild once they're released and able to hunt. So you have all these really elaborate techniques to manage that. Whereas if you're a domestic cat or a hybrid or a feral cat, you're probably subject to a trap, neuter, vaccinate, release program. So the feeding involved is to bait you into a trap so that they can you can be trapped, neutered, vaccinated and released. So the feeding is so different. If you're, and what I'm really interested in, and I was just talking about this in the break, is how, you know, care, routes to care, depend upon whether you're wild or domestic. This is Ollie's work. I've just had the 5-minute warning. Ollie's looking at this in a zoo context. So he's developed this timeline of how feeding is manifest as care in zoos. So it starts off in the 1800s and early 20th century. You care about animals as an asset, an entertainment asset. So you're feeding them, but you're really just feeding them to keep them alive so that they can be entertainment. And then that changes in the mid 20th century to a really anthropomorphic form of care. Animals are anthropomorphized, even infantilized, particularly with primates. And the care is really based on the relationship between the individuals, individual animals, individual keepers. And you get all these really interesting situations like chimpanzees' tea parties. And then it shifts in the late 20th century once you get much more professionalization, much more legislation, vets come into the picture, and care starts to shift. It's much more about collectives, care for, and care is more about nutrition and well-being rather than care for an individual. So you go from this really sort of intimate care to a much more distant form of care. And so you get legislation from the World Animals and Zoos Association where they identify nutrition as a key foundation for zoo animal well-being. And feeding starts to be all about how you can, food is sort of almost preventative medicine. You're avoiding some of the problems that are associated with captive animals, like obesity, dental problems, malnutrition, like nutritional deficits and things. And trying to get some of those natural behaviors again. So there's enrichment, there's more sort of carcass feeding, although that has to be balanced against care for your public because there are human sensibilities around that. And then the last thing I should probably say about Ollie's work is it really is the nutrition that's important. So instead of, primates are a great example again, instead of feeding cultivated fruit, even though fruit is what these species will be eating in the wild, cultivated fruit is really different nutritionally. So we're actually now feeding vegetables, even though there's no way that these primates would be eating vegetables in their natural state. The nutritional profile of vegetables is much more similar to the nutritional profile of wild fruit. So you're sort of feeding for nutrition and care through nutrition. And then, and then we go back
very
to you.
Fast. So our final case study is, so I'm continuing work on pest control governance broadly. And the role of science in that, so in terms of national governments and local government, particularly in the UK. So thinking firstly about public health and issues of animals that are in the wrong place in the city and how that gets decided and contested, so particularly around pigeons and pigeon feeding, and that's in terms of public health and also city planning. So pigeons is one example, seagulls. There's a bit of a urban bestiary around this. So looking at this, and also looking at national government approaches to pest control, which start off post-war as very much about agricultural pests, but then gradually merge into these more urban concerns, and how scientists and experts in both of these domains, as they're researching these problems, they're making major contributions to things like animal welfare science, to field biology, and particularly to ecological ideas, via discovering that if you, say, eradicate an entire population, it bounces back very quickly. So I'm tracing this, and just to close off, an example of how these kind of ideas about care change so radically. So looking at technologies around pest control, which in and of itself is now wildlife management, that we move from technologies that are profoundly about harm and even active cruelty, through to technologies that were at the time considered to be humane. So I'm thinking of gassing here. Through into technologies around trapping, which are both technologies of harm and care, depending on how they're being applied. Thinking also about poisons, and so things like a humane mouse trap. Now, the mouse doesn't care that that's house-shaped. So these things are in some ways less anthropocentric, in some ways continue to be highly anthropocentric. And so thinking again about these different forms of care and how they manifest and change. And at that point, I am stopping. We don't really have a conclusion as such, it's just a stop. But we are trying to develop these ideas, and we really, really want to hear your thoughts about them. Brilliant. And I stop.
Laurie, do you want to come up here now? Just get your PowerPoint up here. What was your PowerPoint called? Compassion fatigue.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, I will.
So just very briefly then, welcome Laura Jane Sheridan, who's a graduate of the Masters in Anthrozoology programme, and she is also the chair of the Animal Free Research UK, doing really interesting work, has a certificate in feline first aid. Oh, did that just bounce?
There we go.
Okay. Anyway, I'll hand over to you.
Thank you very much. So hi everybody, and welcome to my presentation. As Erica said, so I am the chair of Animal Free Research UK, but also was really interested to hear from Kim because I'm also on the board of the Animals and Society Institute. So delighted to be here today, and I will be exploring compassion fatigue in relation to those who work in animal caregiving professions. Okay, so as we know, those who work with animals are required to display compassion in their work. But that same focused empathy makes them really, really vulnerable to being profoundly affected by what they see and even possibly damaged by their work. And the expectation that those in caring professions exposed to this regular suffering can continue doing what they do without being affected has been suggested by Remen to be as unrealistic as expecting to walk through water without getting wet. And as some of you, I'm sure, know, there's very little research into the animal care sector in terms of compassion fatigue. Of the studies that do exist, they're really, really limited. So they really don't explore the prevalence of compassion fatigue in animal care or the factors that might actually contribute to its development in the first place. Again, as I'm sure many of you know, studies into compassion fatigue have been more commonly connected to caring for humans. So there's loads about caring for humans, and there's really, really little about animals. So my research really looks to explore compassion fatigue specifically in relation to caring for animals. And it seeks to explore how compassion fatigue can basically be better understood and prevented and ultimately managed by... Why does this keep doing this? Right, stop it. By those who adopt animal care roles.
So my research has three aims. So the first aim was to explore the factors that influence the prevalence of compassion fatigue in those that are working with animals and the challenges that this might bring. The secondary aim was to examine how those working with animals might achieve what Bavorsok et al. Term the balance between the necessary detachment and compassion those working with animals need to display. And the third aim was to examine basically how the sector might better support the workers in it to manage their well-being and actually retain the staff, which I'll come on to. Okay, so why? One of the key challenges I found was a real lack of consensus into what compassion fatigue actually is in relation to animals, which was a real, real issue in my research. So the research revealed 1,000 alternatives. It's not very scientific, a lot of alternatives to the term compassion fatigue. So some of these are shown here. So these include professional emotional saturation, emotional exhaustion, tension and preoccupation with suffering, feeling overwhelmed, a combination of burnout and traumatization, secondary traumatic stress disorder, countertransference, compassion stress, vicarious traumatization, and what Scotney terms the reduced capacity in being empathetic. So a key challenge here is just a lack of understanding as to what this actually is, but also how compassion fatigue is similar to and yet distinct from burnout. So Rolf suggests that the interchangeable use of the terms compassion fatigue and burnout is one of the key problems here. It, according to Rolf, it adds to the challenges in really determining compassion fatigue's prevalence in the animal care sector, which my research does seem to echo. While burnout did feature in some of the literature that I studied, it was generally considered to be quite distinct from compassion fatigue. So it's believed it is slower to develop and it's more closely associated with external factors. So burnout is more, burnout is more associated with long hours, bad pay, you know, a terrible boss, all these other things. It's quite distinct from compassion fatigue. But then also adding to the confusion, other studies then suggested that those working in animal care roles can experience compassion fatigue and burnout simultaneously, with both manifesting as similar symptoms. So nobody's got a clue, basically. And this confusion is really, really reflected in my research and really suggests the need for further examination. Ultimately, the research into alternative descriptions of the issue has really been quite unsuccessful in actually identifying any real differences between concepts. And Shepherd conveys a complete dislike of the term compassion fatigue altogether due to the implication that animal workers no longer care. Shepherd says, people don't lose compassion, most still want to make a difference, which again my research absolutely echoes. Okay. So my research took place using two pieces of data collection so that we had a real depth of experiences and backgrounds. So it was a combination of in-depth interviews with a group of individuals that I had relationships with to a much broader public survey of a couple of thousand people alongside a review of literature. I won't go into all the details. The individual interviews was sort of open-ended, semi-structured interviews, like I say, with a group of individuals. And then there was the quantitative second phase, which was data collection from animal care employees. I didn't speak to volunteers, it was just employees. So it was the inclusion criteria was limited to those who currently work with animals or those who did work with animals but had decided to leave the sector. Now on to the results. So. When they were asked if they had experienced compassion fatigue, 90% of survey participants said that they had. And this does appear to align with research that suggests that those working with, so the limited research that is out there, suggests that those working with animals are actually at a higher risk of compassion fatigue than any other caring profession, including those who work with humans. Animal care workers have been described as some of the most pain-saturated people the entire caring sector employs. Those caring for animals are possibly drawn to doing so due to a deeper rooted ideological belief system, which means that they really are more likely to experience what Shabram and Maitlis describe as confusion and a really painful tension between deeply held values and the actual realities of the work that they do. And as we know and has been sort of touched on earlier, people who take on caring roles for animals, they probably also either eat them, wear them, deploy animals in their day-to-day lives in some other capacity. Many who profess to love animals, according to Hirschman and Sanders, struggle with issues of edibility, companionship, predation, and domesticability with regard to animals. And my research does suggest that conflicts between the reality and the ideology appear to present a key risk factor for developing compassion fatigue in animal care workers. You can see one of the quotes here from one of the survey respondents. And then there's a couple of other sort of quotes about seeing the world in a very dark light because humankind is exploiting animals in such a horrific way. It can make you feel resentful to people not engaged with the cause. Another one says, it's a real frustration, the contradiction between my role in teaching about animal welfare issues. When my colleagues and managers eat meat, breed their pets, buy puppies and hunt, it really drains you working so hard to change the world for animals to have the people closest to you deliberately making choices that go against what you work so hard for. One of the key things that did come out was this real expectation around coping. Expectations of coping and stoicism. So because you work with animals, you're meant to be really, really stoic about it. There's a sense that you're lucky to work with animals. You should be grateful. There's a real sense that if you can't do your job, someone else will take your job really, really quickly. Everybody wants to work with animals, whereas the human caring sector arguably gets more of a negative I can't think of the word, you know what I mean. So people that work with animals, everybody wants to do this, so it's kind of like just suck it up and get on with it, which was a real consistent issue that came out of my research. One person said, I really think that it's not being discussed in the right way. It's something I feel I should be able to shrug off. I should be able to deal with it, even though that probably isn't true. Okay. So the research looks at three different impacts: the impact on individuals, the impact on the sector at whole, and ultimately the impact on the animals. So individuals, so although compassion fatigue has been described as a normal, healthy reaction to trauma, arguably a defense mechanism that our system puts in place when needed, it's also been referred to as the dark side of caregiving, and its impact has been likened to symptoms experienced by PTSD sufferers. While other studies highlight really, really worrying links between compassion fatigue and compulsive behavior, self-sabotage, and actually substance abuse. Research participants were asked whether their caring role had ever become too much for them. But what was interesting was that for those who said yes, it had become too much, the factors that they blamed seemed to actually be external. So they talked about long hours, low levels of recognition, which again seems to highlight a bit of a lack of understanding, even with the animal care workers, about the difference between compassion fatigue and burnout. I should also say that of all the sectors, the caring sectors, human and animal, I'm going to kill this thing. The sector with the highest suicide rate, I'm sure many of you know, is vets. We'll come on to that in a little bit, but it was very, very obvious, speaking to a lot of the vets, that they were incredibly impacted by this. Okay, impact on the sector, so the animal care sector. So the literature that I examined alongside my research, there's a huge impact on the sector of compassion fatigue and the fact that it's really not being dealt with, which I'll come on to. So this includes frequent absences, inattention to detail, and negativity towards colleagues. And interestingly, instances of compassion fatigue have also been related to excessive compensation claims and increased safety breaches. So participants were asked how it had affected their employment status. You can see here, so 18% had taken time off sick, almost 20% had left their job but remained in the animal care sector. Only 5% had chosen to leave the sector altogether because of their experiences. So my research suggests that by failing to actually treat compassion fatigue, the animal care sector as a whole is really, really at risk. High turnover arguably results in a significant loss of talent and skill within the caring sector, so treating this really, really is imperative. And the University of Florida describes compassion fatigue as critical to the future of both animal welfare and veterinary medicine. Okay, so how the sector currently supports its workers. So a real lack of support was absolutely reflected in the people I spoke to. 86% said they'd never received any support throughout their entire career with animals. Of the 14% who said they had, most said it hadn't been helpful. There was only, do you know what, that doesn't matter, that's something about support networks, but there's only three and they're all in the US and they're all tiny, which is part of the point. You can just see some of the quotes there. Okay. Why? Oh God, sorry. It's because there's an audio on this. Absolutely smashing this presentation, I really am. It's now not even deleting itself. There we go, right. There we go. Okay, so my findings would appear to support similar research into human care workers, which found that those who have developed compassion fatigue commonly adopt defense mechanisms such as deflection, blaming, or denial, which is really, really interesting in terms of this. A lot of this was about human therapists and how they respond to the human that is in their care, and really to look at if that is a standard response for human care workers, what are we doing to the animals, and how do we perceive that in a different but similar way? And there's a lot more in there. And the research echoes findings by Dewey, which suggests that those experiencing compassion fatigue can show loss of focus, lapses in attention at critical moments, and routine errors. And this infographic, this shows just some of the words that people I spoke to shared with me, which is really, really concerning. So there's a lot of real negative emotions in there. We talk about performance at work. So I'm just conscious of time. So it affects their performance at work. Thank you very much. 93% said they were developing feelings of anger or frustration, depression, anxiety, or actually becoming a bit more of adopting a bit more of an apathetic style just to get through the day. Poor mental health of animal caregivers can lead to reduced quality of care for animals, my research suggests. And this was agreed with research by Baranowski, who said that compassion fatigue silencing response is really problematic because it can clip clinical potency and curtail therapeutic work. This thing hates me. Okay, so we'll just move on because clearly this thing wants me to. Right, how might the sector support its staff? A lot. There is a lot that the sector is not doing. People are desperate for support, which came through really, really strongly in my research. So the highest response of anything the sector could do to support its staff was acknowledging it. Acknowledging compassion fatigue is an issue with animal care workers. Nobody talks about it. The number of people I spoke to that said no one's ever asked me this before, quite a few people got quite emotional. They couldn't believe they'd never been asked it. They opened up, the floodgates opened, and they said, please, 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 can the sector just acknowledge this as a thing? And it's similar to, but quite distinct from, compassion fatigue and caring for humans. This is a huge, huge issue. So acknowledgement, displaying transparency and openness in the recruitment process in terms of the demands of the role. Other suggestions were adopting a sense of realism and a recognition that not every animal can be saved. And then a lot of them wanted tools or frameworks. And there was just a lot in there that we don't really have time to go into. But recommending action for the sector is obviously only part of the solution. One survey respondent said that my institution brought in someone to discuss compassion fatigue. The person made a lot of recommendations to leadership on how to support staff. Not one thing has been implemented. I think I'm going to run out of time, so I think I'm going to have to go through this really easily, but really quickly. But managing compassion fatigue, there was a lot that came out, which was really, really great. The most popular coping mechanism was talking to support networks, which does echo other research that I found. Compartmentalising came through constantly. So it was the second most popular strategy. And this does echo research which suggests that creating emotional boundaries between the individual and their work is vital. And then there was a lot about reducing the amount that you're exposed to trauma, self-care. Interestingly, there was quite a bit about time spent with animals as a form of self-care, which I don't have time to go into. And there was a lot more that I also don't have time for. But there was a lot of really, really great potential solutions. So now we're moving on to conclusions. You'll be very glad to know. Oh my God, just doing it again. I just shouldn't be allowed to do presentations, honestly. There we go. Right, conclusions. So it's very much prevalent in animal care workers. I was really overwhelmed by the considerable numbers of requests for help, which people really were desperately wanting. There's a real need for the sector here. There are overwhelming calls for action, help and intervention that participants shared alongside their survey responses, but awareness of the issue is significantly lacking, as we know. And the sector, I would suggest, cannot intervene without a more comprehensive understanding of the issues that it faces. Don't have time to go into more research, but there's a lot more research is needed, as this audio is telling you. And what I was actually thinking, the talks earlier have been fascinating because in addition to the other elements of research that I would absolutely recommend, which I don't have time for, the limitations and challenges were significant. So most participants worked with or on behalf of animals in captivity. The study didn't go into considerations of domestication or speciesism, and it didn't have time to look at how perhaps companion animals versus wild animals. But it was interesting, what Christy was saying earlier about human empathy, it didn't go into insects and things like that, so it was all about companion animals. I mean, thank you for listening to my presentation. Oh my God.
No empathy.
This thing hates me, honestly.
I don't know what's going on there. I'm just going to
do you want to destroy this thing, this evil thing? Okay. I don't know what's going on with that. So, Tona, can I invite you up? For those listening to the talk on audio, the slideshow is going incredibly mad during that talk. And Laura Jane was very, very patient. We have no idea what was going on, but we have an expert poking things at the moment. And so hopefully all will be well for us.
Yeah,
next talk.
I'm nervous now to approach this.
What one was yours, sorry?
It was the Glasgow, yeah.
What a check, there's no setting that's on this.
Ah, oh, use timings.
It might have been that, yeah.
Yeah.
See if it is doing it. You can even just slide off in between the slides.
But I can just use this one, can
yeah,
I?
Yeah, you can do
I?
That.
Because
so
I think I will just be standing here because I need to read
yeah,
the
I'll
notes.
Yeah, I'll just come off then, so I'll leave it to you.
Okay, yeah, good.
Brilliant. sorry, Laura Jane, sorry. So our final speaker in this panel is Tona Droglitro.
Yeah, Tona Droglitro.
I apologise.
No, it's
sorry.
Fine.
Yeah. Who is here talking on a project with Kristin Alsdal.
Yep.
And Tona is a research fellow in science and technology studies at the TIK Centre at the University of Oslo. And she's published on multi-species biopolitics, standardisation, licensing and care in laboratory animal science. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. So it's been really fascinating to listen to all of you. But I will just have to move on quickly because I have am short of time. But so this talk is based upon individual and collaborative work between myself and my colleague Kristin Alsdal. And our work on animals, nature and the natural in science and policy, where we have done a lot of different empirical studies. And I might become a bit theoretical and methodical, even though we're not really allowed to it, I think. But anyway, so care in science and technology studies. Care studies is a key approach in STS that have had significant impact on how values, ethics, and norms are explored in the field. Care studies, it draw closely upon the empirical philosophy as developed within science and technology studies. And key scholars in developing this approach is Anne-Marie Moll, Ingunn Moser, and Jeanette Pauls. And this is the anthology Care in Practice from 2010, sort of is a highlight within the field, I would say, or within this approach. And that book promoted or urged us to study care in practice and as practice. So this the care studies was also emerged as a critique of laboratory studies in STS. And the critique of them was that they were privileging power sites and privileging powerful actors. It's also a critique of It's also a critique of Michel Foucault's way of capturing discourse as one sort of single coherent episteme. So care studies, they said that we rather need to look at, or we also need to look at everyday practices and the mundane. We need to look for multiplicity, the multiple logics and versions of care or realities that are enacted at the same time. And a key premise in care studies was that this had to be done by ethnography. So to ethnographically capture the different and often conflicting logics of good and bad care. And there are also some recent moves in care that have sort of, it's quoted everywhere at the moment, but takes care in a bit of a different direction than care studies, which is a more pragmatic approach as we read it as well, at least. This Bella Casa and Eva Giraud, we would say that perhaps take it in a more critical direction and into what we would call an ethical-political version of care, but we won't engage with that in this particular paper. So we recognize some challenges in care studies, and this is exactly their focus on the ethnographic method in particular. So care as available only by ethnographic method and practice. And also the instigation that care is located in everyday informal practices and located particularly
outside of or in opposition to the typical power domains and the systemic. Or at least that there is a given sort of distinction or opposition between the mundane and the everyday and the systemic and these power domains of science and policy. So what we have been exploring is what could a care and after look like. And the argument of this paper is that care studies can fruitfully be extended towards more sites to be included as sites of care, towards other empirical materials by which care happens and are handled, and also towards new versions of care. So while faithfully following the path carved out by performing critique of earlier versions of SDS, it might also have constrained where care can go and who, where, and what can be captured as care or even analyzed by the lens of care. Wow, okay. So the new sites that we have explored and we suggest that we should pay also more attention to is law, parliament, bureaucracy, and experimental medicine. The new versions of care that we have teased out from our individual and collaborative studies are skilled care, dispassionate or a matter-of-fact kind of care, and procedural care. I don't know why it's lagging. So, but what do these sites have in common? They work by documents. So documents are key to these sites and in actually doing the work that they are doing. So other methods and materials for extending care. So this suggests that for studying care in law, bureaucracy, and medicine, there are other materials that are key to care work that require other methods. And this, so we want to extend care studies concerned with practices to documents in ethnography, in archives, repositories, and databases. And in the anthology Care in Practice, Moser and Poles writes, stressing the verbal too much misses out on the large non-verbal component of what is specific to care practices. So this is a key quotation as I see it in their work. But we would say that stressing the verbal too little results in missing out on important negotiations of and decisions of good and bad in policy and legal domains. So we want to experiment with what we have named, or Kristin actually has named, interested methods. And in this paper, we want to have three cases for care extended. And that is science and dispassionate care, bureaucracy and procedural care, experimental medicine, law, and skilled care. And we only have time to deal with one of these case studies, and we will deal with this one. So the concept of skilled care is developed in the context of a broader work on the history of laboratory animals in Norway, where I trace the radical transformation of animals and animal use in research from the 1950s. The materials I investigated was archive material, legal text, other documents, conversations, and field site visits. So the mid-1950s is a very important and interesting period for experimental medicine and animals in science. During this decade and the decades that followed, scientists would, in more systematic ways than before, work to establish shared standards for the production, distribution, and use of laboratory animals. And the rising interest in and dependency on laboratory animals in biomedicine was closely linked to the increased activities in areas of public health medicine, such as vaccine development and testing of vaccines, diagnostics, and toxicity testing, but also the broader interest in animal research in other disciplines, including veterinary medicine. These experimental yet very routine practices did not only require large quantities of animals, but also animals that were identical at the genetic and pathogenic level. So standardization of laboratory animals as the field was animal science as the field was named, involved modifying animal bodies and developing new modes of working on and with animals in the laboratory context. And the outcome of this work was, first, new types of laboratory animals, Second, clearer distinctions between what was a good and a bad animal. And third, new types of infrastructures and expertise that was oriented around caring for laboratory animals. So what emerges from these standardization moves, I would say, are that laboratory animals emerge as objects of care, as interested objects. And this is then materialized in infrastructures, in technical and legal infrastructures, from modern animal houses to new directives that could navigate between and care for different concerns and interests. It was also a demand for veterinary medical expertise that could combine the technical and affective dimensions of working with animals. And special focus was on laboratory animal disease and modes of handling animals, or the absence of stress was sort of characteristic of this type of care. So what emerges here in this period is that animal and experimental medicine is really invested with much more interest, concern, and care than we have ever seen before. So what version of skilled care is this? So skilled, or kyndig, as the Norwegian word would be for skilled, points to the educated. It also has a practical and a material dimension. Skilled care is a systematic way of approaching the object of interest. It is repetitive, but also demands tinkering and experimenting. Skilled care is relational. It requires the ability to see, feel, and sense animal suffering and well-being. Skilled care is also dispassionate and a matter-of-fact version of care. It is a stabilized form of care because it is standardized and comes with prescriptions, which makes it also transferable across sites and person. So it's a quite peculiar kind of care that we are talking about here. So developing regulations and legal frameworks for animal experimentation have existed in different forms and framings in Norway since the mid-1800s. And in 1974, a new Animal Protection Act was issued, and which pointed out, as you see on the slide behind me, how the natural needs and instincts of animals needed to be cared for in all areas of animal use and interaction. The law distinguished between necessary and unnecessary suffering of animals, reflecting a very utilitarian approach to animal protection. The first animal research directive that was issued 3 years after this act, but was of course mandated by this act, delegated the responsibility of ensuring unnecessary suffering and responding to the natural needs and instincts of animals to veterinary expertise and science. Also, the legal regulatory system had a much more important role. Now experiments had to be much more carefully licensed, which also was a way to respond to the increased public concern for animal suffering in laboratories. Experiments was only allowed in designated sites such as the laboratory animal, and animal research could only be performed by designated people. So the context of this is then, as it is was also in the UK, there is the rise of the animal rights movement, and there's a lot of public discussion and controversy around the use of animals in science, but also other areas in which animals are used. And because of this, there was a much more scientists became much more active in actually promoting experimental medicine, and also themselves as responsible persona in a way. And this was very evident in this issue of Research News, which is a magazine published by the Norwegian Research Council at the time, that took on the question of animal research and ethical dilemmas. So this was quite new in a Norwegian context. I don't think there were similar written published material that would deal with this in this way. So responding to animal rights critique of the use of animals in science, one of the articles were entitled Laboratory Animals Are Necessary for Our Way of Life. It was written by the head of the animal division at the Public Health Institute, and at for a period also he was the secretary general of the International Council of Laboratory Animals, and you see him on the photo behind me, Stian Eriksen. And he wrote that if we were to abolish all animal experiments, it would involve going back to the old days, which involved suffering and pain on a significant and unprecedented scale. So using animals made up for the potential harms on society as a whole. And he continued to point out that the key premise in veterinary medicine was how good animal care equaled good science, which again equaled good health and good welfare for all. So this, I would say, is a matter-of-fact kind of care, a dispassionate form of care, and demonstrate how one can be dispassionate but also interested at the same time. So it's no less about care, but it is a particular kind of care. And Erikson's move stood in stark contrast then to the animal rights claims that aim to more emotionally move people, placing reason up against emotional and passionate capacities. And this is a very interesting tension and also clearly enact conflicting versions of care at the time. So what does skilled care do in the laboratory animal context? What has been the role of skilled care in the experimental system? It's been to ensure good science, care for animals, contain social controversy, sustain professional identity, and facilitate for expansion and sophistication of models and practices. So a lot of things are really, a lot of things embody this sort of, or skill care embody a lot of different things and values and logics of care. And a jump to the contemporary situation. So today we talk about a culture of care in animal research. The culture of care is sustained and secured by a range of different practices and mechanisms, among other things, a sophisticated regulatory and ethical system. And this system is to a significant extent based upon document practices and different types of documents. So on this slide you see then the Norwegian version of such a system. It is oriented then towards what they call fostering a culture of care. And the background for this arrangement is the EU directive from 2010 that introduced also the three R's, the replacement, reduction and refinement, as key principles that could organize the whole practice. So this system depends upon both skilled and dispassionate care, but also what I have called procedural care. So procedural care points to how the regulatory system and public officials in this system is required to care not only for animals and science, but also for the procedures of the system. So public officials are, as I have found at least in my research, they are very much concerned with establishing good procedures. So good procedures are for them important in order to then enable this culture of care. So there are so many different layers of care and layers of interest that go into this care that is then at the sort of core of animal research today. So, and these good procedures then, for instance, involves working on and making documents better in terms of enabling scientists to articulate harms and benefits of research, and also for themselves to be able to evaluate animal suffering, and also to evaluate scientific reliability. So documents and rhetorical devices are what sort of enables actually this practice, but has really not been explored that much, I would say. So I'm still within time. I must have... Oh, really? Okay, sorry for talking very fast. I was so afraid that I wouldn't and come to my last slide. But okay, so then I can have my last slide. We want to summarize and draw things together in this talk by then experimenting with this concept of interested methods, which is actually also speaking to another debate, which is about interference and intervention as a scholar. How do you sort of... what is interference, what is intervention, and how do we do it in a way? But anyway, I won't take that here now. But the initial intention then with the empirical philosophy of science and technology studies was that of employing a vocabulary that did not carry too much weight on its own, but to let the material get sufficient space to act back upon the researcher. The CARE studies that followed in its wake adopted this methodological approach. Values, ethics, and the normative was to be teased out from the material. However, the naming already, CARE studies, signaled what one was looking for. Not the managerial, the factish, the already quantified, but the goods and the bads in the relational, and in settings where care was expected to be found. So we propose that interested methods can be a good place to work from in a shared effort to study care. With this we mean that we need to be careful not to be overtly programmatic. Methods are invested with interest. They are made fit to take us some places but might prevent us from going somewhere else. The researcher is always also equipped with, in part, disciplinary methods. Methods that work like instruments which enable us to see some things and not others. So we are instrumentized, as Latour says. And methods are performative. They do things in encounter with the stuff they look at and work upon, and they modify worlds. And this is also why we should look at documents, document practices, to understand what care is all about in many different areas of society. And I think I actually finished there, but I want to also have a last sort of slide. I haven't included the other than us work, that, but this is where we draw our examples from our own work that we have published, and we're hoping that we're able to bring out also more of these cases to discuss actually this, how we can think about the concept of care, how we can approach the concept of care in different ways, in different areas and practices. So thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. That's thank you.